Network Stars is a team competition. So, let's meet the team.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of FW Presents, the anthology show of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. In this episode, we're talking about those comics characters that aren't supposed to do too well. We call them Morts. And I'm joined by a trio of network all-stars, none of them Morts. It depends on who you ask. I'm one of your hosts, Siskoid, but please welcome in the virtual studio with me, my evil twin from another mother from the Fire and Water and JLI podcasts. It's the irredeemable Shag.
Hello. I am, in fact, a Mort. If you look in the dictionary, you'll find a picture of me.
My nearest and dearest neighbor from Nightcast, Cheercast, and FW Records, Ryan Daly.
I am a one-off if ever there was one.
And also from Nightcast, Supermates, and JLU Cast, Kentucky's own Chris Franklin.
Oh, that's a low blow. No, I was actually featured in Wizard Magazine number 57, if you go back and look.
So. Now, if you're a Fire and Water Patreon supporter at a certain level, you can suggest a show. And this is, in fact, a suggestion from Chris Lewis, who wanted to hear the Network All-Stars talk about their favorite Morts. So this one goes out to you, Mr. Lewis.
Unfortunately, the All-Stars couldn't be here, so you got us instead.
The All-Stars are Max, Nathaniel, and Rob. So yeah, we've all prepared a Mort, but I think there are questions we should try to answer first. Like, Shag, you already did a show where you toured the country and asked friends of the network who their favorite Morts were, right?
I did.
Yes.
All the way back in 2016, I traveled the country. It's Fire and Water, Aquaman and Firestorm, Fire and Water number 180, if anyone wants to hear it. Had Stella, Tom Panarese, Keith G. Baker, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, Kyle Benning. It's like an all-star list right here. Doug Zawisha, Little Russell Burbage, Professor Alan Quarterman, Aaron Bias, Ben Avery, Luke Dobb, and Jared Albrecht. So all those folks chimed in. But yeah, so we recorded an episode. They're talking about our favorite Morts.
But you didn't tell anyone yours.
I don't remember. I haven't listened. It's been 5 years. I don't know.
We weren't on there. So you've done some of the work. So I'll ask you first, what qualifies you to be a Mort? What is a Mort?
So you just asked what qualifies me to be a Mort? Really, Siskoid? Well, I'm taking that personally.
You the character, you out there, the comic book character who's listening.
Sure. So, all right, let's take a step back a little bit far, and Chris sort of led with it when he mentioned Wizard. As far as we can tell, that term Mort was popularized by Wizard in the 1990s, right? For the comic book community, that is. And so I dug in a little bit more, like, where does this word come from? According to Urban Dictionary, it says anything used to describe someone who lacks a sense of life, who looks dumbfounded, and has only a limited ability to learn and understand, often excluded from society. Okay.
You were talking about me.
I was, yeah, well, it's right. So that sort of ties in with how we look at Morts, right? And in fact, here's a really where I think it comes from. Because I kept asking, okay, Urban Dictionary, that's obviously modern. Where does it originally come from? Well, the Latin root word mort is apparently tied in with the word mortal. And mortal is someone who death will someday claim. And by talking about Morts, these are the kind of people that, you know, if they go out there, they might get themselves killed because they'd be so bad at being a hero or a villain. These are the people who are not ready for primetime players, basically. They're the losers. You know, if it was sports, they wouldn't even be good enough to make the minor leagues or the farm teams.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I understand what Mort means in that sense because French has a lot more Latin in it. And Mort, mort, means dead. Or death in French. So, yeah, to me that was obvious. But go ahead.
That's fine. You just said it was obvious and I'm, you know, wasting everyone's time by telling everyone. So thanks for that. Now, man, makes you a mort, sir. So for a hero, their heart might be in the right place, which is what my mort is like, but they don't have what it takes to be taken seriously. You know, it's the kind of hero that Spider-Man looks at and says, look, kid, if you go out there, you're going to get yourself killed. You know, that's kind of where Morts fall. And they're not necessarily defined by their number of appearances, but the bottom line is they simply don't have the ability or the common sense or the gimmick or dress sense, for that matter, or the luck to be a successful character. And it could be a hero. It could be a villain. They might be treated as a joke or they might be treated seriously. Like, I could even argue Dr. Light back in the 60s could be argued to be a Mort because he just wasn't successful. He got his butt beat by the Teen Titans all the time. But he wasn't a joke at the time. So you can be serious or a joke and still be a Mort.
Do we agree, guys?
Yeah. That sounds better.
Yeah, right. I definitely think that, you know, the Mort is somebody who's just, like, I think the not ready for prime time player is, like, is the apt analogy. It's somebody who's just, you never expect them to win. There's really, there shouldn't be any reason to see this character again. Like, they're just kind of, like, created for weird. I also think, like, another type of Mort example or type, like, if you have a character or a villain that is just badly disproportionate in terms of their power or their gimmick to whoever their nemesis is, like, I'm thinking, like, the Marvel villain Plant Man, as an example. Mm-hmm. He, now, he's had some exposure over the years, but his first appearance, he originated as a villain for the Human Torch in his solo Strange Tales appearance. Now, can you see a problem with a villain whose plants are his like his whole gimmick going up against the Human Torch? Why that might seem like, okay, I don't think this guy's gonna go the distance. I don't see him like starring in a 6-part miniseries like Epic or something like that. Same thing with like Boomerang, who eventually became one of the deadly foes of Spider-Man and one of like the lead of the Superior Foes great story arc. But he needed to find his, you know, his particular like lane to be that level, because his first appearance was in the Incredible Hulk. Boomerang versus the Hulk. Again, you look at that, and with his first appearance, it's like, that is a Mort. That guy should not be walking away into the next issue. So some of these characters can be redeemed over time, but yeah, like something like that, it might be another example or another type of Mort, when you just look at them and it's like, why are you a thing? Like, why are you going up against like Captain America? But
I think that's really interesting. And we will ask whether or not we see a future for the Morts we've picked, or like a possible future, because, well, yes, they can be redeemed. And maybe they were just in the wrong book at the wrong time. That's a great point. But I do think that the number of appearances can be a factor in these things, because sometimes you have a perfectly good character and they're just made for like the one story or for a few stories, or they were never really reused again and you wonder why. Somebody out there must have thought they were Morts, but maybe fans don't. The few appearances, the character that appears only once, like at the beginning of an issue, Superman beats him real quick and then moves on to Brainiac or whatever. That character can be interesting, but maybe was, you know, built to be garbage, just to be trashed immediately.
I'll give you a perfect example of that, since this network started with Aquaman and Firestorm. Firestorm had one of those, a character called Bazooka Joan, who was completely a trash throwaway character, who was there for maybe, I don't even know, half an issue, maybe a page or two. It was specifically there just to get their butt beat. And that's a great example of the more you're talking about.
Yeah, so we'll have all sorts. What is their appeal? Because obviously, they must have one, or else we wouldn't have favorites, quote-unquote. So, what do we see in them that comics publishers don't, perhaps? Ryan, tell us what you think.
So, listeners, you are right now hearing a group of people chatting who started on a blog and then podcast devoted to Aquaman and Firestorm. Those of us who love comic books and love the superhero genre, I mean, forget about the fact that superhero movies are now expected to make $1 billion. Comic books are still a niche medium within the genre of popular culture. And I think for those of us, because we've always had an affection, we've always been in love with this niche type of art form, we have a pull towards that niche, that underdog, that like a more obscure thing. Now, the Morts, we're talking about the nichest of the niche. Like they go full by. And it's like, yeah, you know, everybody, nobody's going to turn your nose if you say your favorite hero is Batman or Superman or Spider-Man. And there's nothing wrong with those characters. But it takes a real sense of courage and a real sense of purpose in your life to say, the Human Flying Fish, man, I ride or die with that guy. So I think there's something about us and our type of, you know, the fandom that we gravitate to and the people within our community, we're kind of programmed to like the more obscure, something that takes a little bit more TLC in order to find the redeeming value in this. We look for that value and we love it and we work with it, and it makes us feel like we're championing something that gets overlooked. There's also, I mean, comic books and superheroes are escapist fiction, and we project ourselves into the superheroes, and we like to live vicariously through their adventures. But at some point, when you're a little bit more reflective and you sit back and you're like, I could never be Batman. I don't have the dedication, the physicality, the resources. I could never even be Robin. But Buona Beast, maybe? Yeah, I could, you know, maybe that's something, you know.
So you're saying we're underdogs, so we appreciate underdogs.
I think that is part of it. I think that is part of the reason why people in our community, we have a fascination and a love for some of these Mort characters, and we really want to root for them because we see ourselves in them. You know, we're not going to make the Avengers. That's, you know, we're not those guys. But
speak for yourself, man. I'm aiming for the Great Lakes.
Well, with the initiative, you could be anywhere, you know.
I think sometimes, you know, it can be, like in the case of the one that I'm going to bring up, it can literally be like how you encountered them, where you encountered them, that they left this impression, you know, on you that you're just like, what was that? And why did I never see him again? Why were they not in Ohotmu? Why were they not in Who's Who? And then when they do resurface, I mean, you've got this little tiny flame burning for this character to a point. And then when somebody else does use them, you're like, aha, you know, somebody else gets it. And I guess that kind of ties into what Ryan was saying too. But it's just this weird little, like, you're the only person that knows about this character, even though you're not. Obviously, other people read that comic book too. But because nobody else brings it up, that you're like, even if you're not really a fan of that character, but there's a certain fondness for that character just because you encountered them and didn't realize, you know, that there were thousands of other people, probably really honestly until, I guess, you know, fanzines and stuff, but really honestly, a Google search would bring this character up and say, oh, other people actually acknowledge that this character did exist for at least a brief blip in the publishing history of DC or Marvel or whoever.
A perfect example of that, Chris, would be, again, taking it back to Firestorm. The first Firestorm comic I ever read was Firestorm number 28, featuring the patron saint of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Slipknot, who was taken completely seriously in the comic book. He shouldn't have been, but he was. And now he's a bit of a punchline. And yet, we all love him because it's so ludicrous. A guy with rope, and he's in the Suicide Squad movie and all these things for the very purpose of dying. Spoiler, sorry.
And they make him fight Firestorm.
Right, exactly. So I love that character simply because, like you said, it was the time of my life. It was the first Firestorm comic I ever bought.
Yeah, no. Sometimes you look at characters, like the first time you encounter them, you think they're a bigger deal than they really are because you have no sense of the history. Mm-hmm. You're disappointed later. And finally, like the third question I want to ask is, are there different kinds of Morts? We've sort of broached the subject, but do we treat all Morts alike?
No, I don't think so. And like I think, like Shaq said, there's hero Morts and there's villain Morts and there's characters that were literally just meant to, like the Bazooka Jones example that Chad gave, that just were literally meant to be a one-off, like the cold open of a comic and never appear again. But then there were other Morts that the creators probably thought, okay, this is a character that I can put in the toolbox, that I can bring out again. Maybe I'll, even if I'm on another title, I'll find some use for him down the road. And reader reaction was like, what were you thinking? You know, basically. So I mean, it is kind of a strange thing to try to define because, I mean, it can be intentionally so silly and over the top that it's like, oh, well, that's instantly a Mort. Or, you know, it can be like they were completely sincere with this combination of elements, you know, in this character, or, you know, or it could be just because they had a one-off appearance in a comic that got canceled and creators didn't move on to other books. And then, so yeah, I mean, there's so many different categories for Mort. It's just, it's like, you just know one when you see one. I don't know how else to describe it.
All right. Well, we'll give four examples, and I think we ran the gamut as far as this goes. We've got heroes, we've got villains, we've even got an anti-hero. We've got one-offs, we've got characters with a lot of appearances. So we've got Marvel and we've got DC. So good job, guys. Thanks for the diversity. So let's start with Shag. Shag, who did you pick and why?
Sure. So when I think of the not ready for primetime players, I picked Frogman, the ludicrously bizarre, mostly a joke character, Frogman. Now, when Chris was defining all the different categories, this guy falls in the category of he was never taken seriously, and he was never intended to be taken seriously, but he's a favorite character of a creator, exactly like Chris was kind of describing. So in this case, here's the gist of the character. His real name's Eugene Petilio, and he first appeared in Marvel Team-Up number 121, which was September 1982. And he was created by J.M. DeMatteis and Cary Gamble. And it's sort of interesting. He's actually a legacy character. His father was a supervillain called Leapfrog, who used to fight Daredevil. Was created all the way back in 1967 by Stan Lee and Gene Colan. I think we've heard of that guy. And Leapfrog went on to fight Iron Man and Spider-Man and everything. But he sucked. He was a failed hero. He ended up in jail. So eventually the father tries to make it straight. He tries to get a real job, but he can't make ends meet. So the son, Eugene, always feels bad that the dad has this sort of specter of Leapfrog hanging over his head. So Eugene gets this idea with the best of intentions, and he's probably late teens, I would guess. Eugene, with the best of intentions, decides to help his father redeem the Leapfrog name. So he decides the only way to do this is to become a hero. So Eugene gets out his dad's old suit and these springs. I'll describe the costume in just a minute. And quite literally, he leaps into action. And unfortunately, Eugene is extraordinarily clumsy in his battle against crime. He runs into Spider-Man and the Human Torch, and he completely, by accident, in a very Jar Jar Binks kind of way, succeeds in defeating the criminal named Speed Demon. Now, encouraged by his victory, Eugene decides to become a hero and calls himself the Fabulous Frogman. And Frogman basically has a tendency of capturing villains by dumb luck. He has this inability to pilot this automated frog costume, which is supposed to jump on these giant springs, and he bounces along, defeating villains basically by crashing into them. And from there, he's had a ton of appearances. So this is a mort that I would say has a lot of appearances. So a single appearance didn't define him, but it's almost always with a comedic twist. You know, Spider-Man is consistently trying to coach Eugene into giving up being a superhero. He's always worried Eugene's going to get hurt. But yeah, he's a very funny, intentionally humorous mort, and I love him, and that's why I had to pick him.
He's also a favorite of the girls on the Oh Hot Mort Not podcast.
Yes, they are.
That fueled an FW team-up where Emily really wanted to talk about Frogman. It's a Frogman-Spider-Man team-up. So he's quite lovable, just goofy-looking, but lovable. Is the look like an important part of a mort?
In his case,
could you have like a badass costume and still be a mort, or, you know?
Well, Slipknot's got a badass costume. So at least I would argue he does. So, in this case, yes, a costume. And in fact, in my why I picked him area, this is one of the things. I absolutely adore his look. He looks like a giant cartoon frog, not like a realistic frog, like a cartoon frog. It's hilarious. You can't help but look at him. He's designed to look overweight because both Eugene's overweight, but also the frog's sort of rotund. The face looks like a goofy, you know, cartoon drawing of a frog. You could argue maybe a little bit of Kermit the Frog in there. He's one of the things I absolutely love about this character is in order to see, Eugene wears a giant frog mask, right? Well, he has to look through the open mouth. So whenever it's drawn, you see these two white eyes shining inside the giant frog mouth, which cracks me up. It reminds me a lot of like Muppets with these big old eyes or like Scooby-Doo. Like when the lights go out, you know, in a Scooby-Doo cartoon, you can still see the eyes floating along. You can see the eyes inside of the Frogman costume. It's hysterical. I absolutely love it. And you mentioned that Marvel Team-Up issue, so I got to talk about this. That's actually where I first encountered Frogman, and that's what drove me to pick this. It was Marvel Team-Up number 131. It wasn't his first appearance. It was 10 issues after that. But I used to work in a comic shop a billion years ago, and this comic was on display in our store, not because it was valuable or anything, but we had an area where just a lot of covers that we thought were interesting were on display. And I would stare at this cover, man. I would just stare at it and stare at it and stare at it because it's freaking hysterical. It's a Marvel Team-Up. It's got the Spider-Man logo. It's got the Frogman logo. The Frogman logo's in goofy bubble letters and looks a little froggish. And in the foreground is this very sexy woman dressed as the White Rabbit and very skimpily dressed and mounted on like a heads that have been mounted like a taxidermist would on the wall is Spider-Man's head and Frogman's head. And there's like funny words like Spider-Kiss, Itticus, and Frogulus, Megafoolus. Anyway, it's just goofy. It is a hilarious cover. It's engaging. It's sexy with White Rabbit. And it just, I would stare at it and stare at it and stare at it. And finally one day I just bought it. It didn't cost anything. I finally pulled the trigger on it. And it was everything I'd hoped for. You know, Frogman's completely inept, and yet he's still trying to do everything he can. The foe of the issue, White Rabbit, is absolutely bonkers. I mean, she is seriously crazy. And it's just a really, really fun, fun comic. I actually covered it on an old episode of Back to the Bins. You covered it, like you said, on FW Team-Up. And it brings me a lot of joy, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
He's fun. And Do you have any, like, favorite moments that you want to relate across his whole history?
Obviously, that issue, Marvel Team-Up 131, is great. The other one that's worth mentioning, and I just read this recently, is Spectacular Spider-Man number 185. So this came out, I don't have the year on it. I think it's 92, if I remember. Oh, yeah, February 92. And the whole issue is it's basically a sequel to the Marvel Team-Up, because what's happened is the White Rabbit has come back. And again, she's still insane, she's still sexy, Frogman's completely inept in the issue, Spider-Man is so frustrated. And it's funny to read this, because Spider-Man, he feels like the only adult in the room with this crazy, because you've got White Rabbit, you've got this dumb character named Walrus, you've got Frogman, you've got Frogman's dad, Leapfrog, and again, Spider-Man is like the sensible one who's like, can everyone just grow the heck up? And it's just bonkers. So where I'd really glom in on this, because when I read it, I had no idea what I was getting into. It's written by J.M. DeMatteis, right? The guy who wrote Justice League International, or scripted it, which I happen to do a podcast about. Well, it turns out that this issue came out the same month he ended his run on Justice League International. So he wrote this issue as a farewell to Justice League International, oddly enough. It's full of JLI gags. They've got them legitimately saying "bwah ha ha" in there. On the news, there's a whole thing. They're talking about basically Guy Gardner. There's a one-punch gimmick. It's a one-finger gimmick, but it's the same thing. And at the end, he literally dedicates the issue to Keith Giffen, Andy Helfer, and Kevin Maguire. It's great. So in the story, though, there's this super, super awkward moment, which cracks me up. It's a family dinner. It's very, very domestic. So Frogman, or I should say Eugene, out of costume, has invited Spider-Man over for dinner with his family. So Spider-Man shows up in costume, and during dinner, he like pulls his mask up so he can eat and drink. And Eugene's, of course, in plain clothes. Everyone else is in plain clothes. And in there is Eugene's dad, who, if you think about it, okay, so Spider-Man's got Eugene there, who's this inept kid who he's trying to get to stop being a superhero. Eugene's dad, who's Spider-Man's old foe, so he's like one of his old enemies, and Eugene's Aunt Marie. And she's made this giant, very traditional Italian dinner. Spider-Man stops by at this local bakery, and he shows up with, like, baked goods, which just looks so weird to see Spider-Man knocking on a door and delivering baked goods. And the whole thing's super uncomfortable and very, very domestic, as they're, like, sitting on couches, drinking tea. It is a riot. Eugene's trying to pal up to him the whole time, and it really conveys that awkwardness that just makes me so happy. And Eugene, and it really also it demonstrates Eugene's mortness too, because it's showing him as just basically a typical kid in a family setting. He has no business being a superhero. This is not what a bumbling, what a superhero's life is like. He's just a bumbling fool. So that's a moment that I absolutely adore and cracks me up when I read it.
What about you, Chris? Ryan, do you have any strong feelings about Frogman? Is he a good mort?
I don't like Frogman, but I stan his father, Leapfrog. And yeah, no. And
get off the call.
Functionally, they're almost the exact same character just because of the costume and everything. And Leapfrog doesn't have as much history. Although, listeners of the Fire and Water Network, if you go back last year, I believe, to an early episode of FW Presents Showcase Gene Colan, Siskoid and I talked about Daredevil issue 26. Which did feature Leapfrog in there. And he was the character. He's on trial for his crimes and everything, and the prosecutor makes the dumb move of giving him his costume to put on in front of the jury, and Leapfrog puts on his boots and his suit and everything and jumps through the window to try and escape. Except when he goes out the fifth floor of the federal courts building in New York, one of his boots falls off, so when he lands, he's unbalanced and he breaks his leg. So,
oh my gosh. So he was treated as a joke back then too? Is that fair to say?
Was, yeah, in that sense, a little bit, yeah. It was, I mean, that part was kind of looking at, the ridiculousness. A little bit he was, yeah.
He's certainly no stilt man.
Yeah, he was the other, who was the A villain of that episode. What I think makes Frogman the mort, more than like whatever stories he has, whatever story you tell with him, I do think it kind of boils down to the costume, because there's nothing inherently silly or gimmicky about having frog powers. Tons of characters have powers based on weird things in the animal kingdom. Frogs are fine. There's agility, there's leaping, there's lots of things you can do with that. It's fine. But, Shag, as you were describing the costume, the thing about just seeing the guy's eyes in the mouth of the frog head, he looks like the team mascot for a baseball franchise or something.
Yes!
Like that. He looks like, yep, it's like the green monster or something at a hockey game or whatever. You're just like watching this guy. So as soon as you see that, you can't help but laugh and you think, this guy, did he steal this costume? Did he sew this himself? Like, this is not a real superhero or supervillain. Like, it immediately, just like the look of that costume, the hood/helmet over his head, it instantly brings out a chuckle, which lowers him to that Mort status. It doesn't matter how many issues he's been in, or, you know, what Avengers, or if he knocked out Thanos or something like that. You look at him and you giggle.
Yeah, that he looks like a character at a theme park, you know, that's walking around. Not a good theme park either, one of those knockoff ones, you know. I have a close connection to Frogman. I bought that Marvel Team Up number 121 right off the stands, and it just so happened that I bought it the day my dad smashed off his pinky finger.
Ooh.
At work. So my mom, or most of his pinky finger, he's still got a little nub. My mom picked me up from school, and I guess my mom had been at the hospital with my dad, you know, and she was like, we're going to stop by the pharmacy and the drugstore and pick up your dad's prescriptions. I guess my mom told me about, well, your dad, you know, hurt his finger, and, you know, it's going to look different. He's got it bandaged up and all this. And, you know, I don't know how old I was. What was that? Was that 82? So I was like, you know, I don't know, 6, 7, something like that. And so, so she takes me in there. So I buy, you know, it's Spider-Man the Human Torch. I'll buy this. And, you know, the Frogman on the cover is just this green silhouette that is not the shape of Frogman that it points to. And the cover's a riff on The Flash, because Speed Demon, Ed Hannigan draws him in Carmine Infantino Flash running style with the after images and the speed lines. And there's even the little hands with the captions that point in the cityscape, and even Barry Allen and Iris are on the cover, so it's a Flash pastiche. But inside, then you're introduced to Frogman, you know. So after that, then I got the White Rabbit one, and then he'd show up in the Amazing Spider-Man and team up with Spider Kid, who is this kid that developed, he's another Mort we could have covered. He started out as a Doc Ock fan, and then he took his Doc Ock arms and made spider arms, and he dressed up in a he's overweight too, and he wears glasses over this Spider-Man mask, and they team up, and the Toad becomes involved at one point, and they're called the Misfits, and Spidey's just, you know, the whole time like wanting to beat his head against a brick wall every time these guys show up. So it was a lot of fun whenever Frogman showed up, and I know Ryan's done this, and so have I. I had to buy the Marvel Legends action figure when it came out recently. Just absolutely had to have it. So yeah,
as we prepared for this call, I broke a couple of nights ago and ordered both the Frogman and White Rabbit action figure off eBay. They'll be here in a few days. Oh my gosh,
sweet.
Yeah, I mean, at some point we got to ask, is he on the cusp of greatness? Because he's got his action figure. I mean, he's not that minor a character anymore, I guess. Shag, do you have any hopes and dreams for Frogman? Where do you want to see him go next?
Oh, okay. So I got this worked out, right? Okay, first of all, the action figure means his profile's raised already. They've already done his main villain, White Rabbit, as an action figure. Let's face it, she's hot. She got done first. But he is primed, not for like a live action thing. I mean, I have no aspirations of being live action, but he is primed for an animated explosion on the Marvel universe, you know, the Disney corner of the Marvel universe. Because first of all, there's precedent already. There was a cartoon called Fantastic Four: World's Greatest Heroes. It didn't get a lot of play over here. It was only one season, but it was so not well received. They stretched it out over 3 years to air it all. But Frogman appears in one of the episodes. He actually tries out for the Fantastic Four to become Thing's replacement, but gets rejected. So they've already kind of stuck him out there as a bit of a joke character already. Now think about it. The next Spider-Man cartoon, because it's just a matter of time, right? Till there's another Spider-Man cartoon. There always is. You stick Frogman in one episode as like a joke or whatever. Then boom, he breaks out and has an entire episode of What If dedicated to him, right? What if Frogman saved the universe? And someone has said it earlier, what if he knocks out Thanos? It's Frogman clocking Thanos. I mean, it's ridiculous, almost, you know, not in Fred Hembeck style, but not artwork, but Fred Hembeck ludicrousness of the little ridiculous character beats the biggest bads and saves the universe. I mean, that would be the what if. It would all be tongue-in-cheek. It would all be hilarious. Marvel could do it up perfectly. It would be, you get like a Patton Oswalt to do the voice or something. It would be an absolute hoot. So yes, I think the Frogman absolutely has a strong future with Marvel.
That's a good casting. Squirrel Girl can do it. Frogman certainly can.
I can see Frogman appearing in like one of the Disney Plus shows like Ms. Marvel or She-Hulk or something like that, especially if She-Hulk goes something of the comedic route with, if it's based on like the Dan Slott run or something like that. I can see somebody like a Frogman or Leapfrog appearing on that. Give him like the homemade costume like Spider-Man in Homecoming, like his before he gets his, you know, Tony Stark suit, everything like that. Something along those lines.
I was going to say, I could honestly see in the movies, like, take Ned from the Tom Holland movies and just make him Frogman.
Oh, geez.
You know, he puts on a suit. Boom. Yeah. Yeah.
That would work. It's almost like they've already written it in. So, okay, Ryan, let's give it up to you. Let's move into the DC universe and you give us your Mort.
Yeah, Cisco and I were talking about this sort of topic, and something that you said kind of popped up in my mind, like a character who was never meant or never intended to have a second appearance or something like that. So I was like, okay, is there a good character I like who died in his first appearance? And I flashed back to an issue of Black Canary that I covered on the Flowers and Fishnets or Power of Fishnets, one of the podcasts that I did about it a long time ago.
One of the ones you canceled, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. And the one that I picked, the character, was a villain in Black Canary issue 7, and his name was Capoeira, or Capoeira. Capoeira, if you do not know, it originated in Brazil. It is a type of martial arts fighting style that is also partially based on gymnastics and dance. And it originated as a form, like, when people, oppressed people, were not allowed to train to fight, they practiced these gymnastics that they were able to adapt and modify into a form of combat. So, I mean, you can go on YouTube and you can look up Capoeira and see what it is. It's a lot of tumbles, a lot of flips, a lot of kicks and things like that that seem like it's kind of like a parkour type of exercise with some dancing thrown in that can also use your body in a kind of weaponized fashion. If you want even more information about this, go to the Bob's Burgers episode when Tina Belcher, Bob's daughter, learns about this and refers to it as sexy dance fighting. It's brilliant. Anyway, so in Black Canary issue 7, we meet the character Capoeira, also known as the Dancer, and picture a sort of flamenco dancer type. He has very high-waisted pants, those like tight, high boots up to the knees. His pants are black. His shirt is black, but it's got those billowy sleeves and everything like that. He's got brown leather boots, brown leather gloves. He's got a black mask that covers his eyes and his hair, like the Dread Pirate Roberts, so there's a little bit of a Zorro effect too, and this bright green vest and a bright green cape. And he does this dance, and he's entrancing these people, but in his gloves, he has these rubber padded gloves that can do like deliver electroshocks, so he can hit you with the palm of his hand and deliver enough electricity to kill you. He also has stiletto blades embedded in his boots, so when he's doing these twirls and these kicks and these flips, he can slice your throat. He's very, very deadly. The thing that I liked about him is, like, when you read the story, you kind of find his backstory. His name is Jesus Valdez. He was a poor migrant farmer or migrant worker. His family, his mother essentially worked herself to death. And one year after her death, the Dancer, Capoeira, was born. And he started going around killing all of these wealthy landowners. And it started off as an activist, a political upstart who was fighting for social and economic justice and fighting the wealthy upper class, you know, like the one percenters. And he was targeting them for revenge, and eventually he crossed the lines and becomes a killer. By the end of the story, he's killed because he goes up against Dinah and she breaks a water pipe in a sprinkler system. The water splashes on his gloves, electrocutes him, he's dead. So he just has this one appearance, and because of the nature of the story and the way Sarah Byam wrote it and Trevor Von Eden drew it, you can read that entire issue in 90 seconds. So this character should not have had a lasting impact. He was a done one. But when I read that issue, I was like, this guy has a great look. He's got, you know, a fancy gimmick. You know, he's you know, for a Street Fighter, for like a street level hero like a Black Canary or Green Arrow or a Blue Beetle or something like that, he's on the streets. He's got a very flashy and physical type of fight style. He's also got an agenda that is more than just, you know, he's out for money. He wants revenge, and he's targeting people that today are not the most sympathetic people in the world. And he's got a cause, a sense of justice that has just been kind of twisted over time. So I've always really liked this character, and now he's killed off, but DC continuity is kind of a joke. So
pretty fluid, yeah.
any writer, any artist could bring him back whenever they want in any medium, in the comics, in a TV show, in a movie, or whatever. And you can play with this guy, and you can make him a much more sympathetic, more compelling character, even an anti-hero, or just a flat-out hero. Since today, you know, we don't really like, you know, billionaire landowners anymore. And, you know, when you look at the protests and the causes and the fights for social justice that have sprung up over the last couple of years, in particular the last year, I think a character like Capoeira could probably have a pretty sizable impact and get some notice and some love if he was brought back today.
You recommended this issue to me when I was doing an article on Black Canary, and I really enjoyed it and the character. So it's really too bad that he had to die, but I mean, we're two or three continuities from that.
Yeah. Well, even back then, dead never meant dead. I mean, come on.
Yeah, that series, which was not a good series, did have like 4 or 5 interesting villains that were created just for Black Canary, and they all died. They killed them all off. So I was like, all right, good luck. Good job there, buddy.
I just know it from Ryan's coverage, but I kind of liked his love child of Dr. Midnight and Firestorm look. I like that, you know, that the poofy sleeves and the vest and the green and, you know, I thought it was kind of a nice look. The knives and the boots reminded me of the Spider-Man Foe the Tarantula, yes, which I think is a cool gimmick. But, I mean, yeah, I think this guy, you know, had a lot of, you know, I think he does have some potential. I really do. It's another interesting take because, you know, we talked about, you know, clearly Frogman was intended to be a Mort from the beginning. This guy's only a Mort because he was killed off and he was in a forgettable series. I mean, everybody loves Black Canary, but per Ryan's coverage, woof, this series, I mean, I like some Trevor Von Eden art, but I don't know what phase he was going through in the art in this book at this time. I still think of that one shot of Dinah, in, like, is she in prison or something? And she doesn't have the wig on, and she looks like she's got an inflated, it's like she's got one of those sumo suits on, and her head's poking out of it. So yeah, it's a rough series just from the scans that Ryan shared. But I think this guy's got some potential to for somebody to pick up. And like you guys said, DC continuity, yeah, that means absolutely nothing that he died. So, you know, somebody pick this guy up and do something with him.
Another problem that the character has is that he is based on a particular martial arts style. That's what makes him interesting. It's also what makes him hard to draw. And I find that very few artists are able to do specific martial arts styles. So whenever I see it, I really enjoy it.
I haven't seen this character. I'm not familiar with it. But from everything you described, I mean, it sounds quite a bit like this character, Jim Cotta, was perfect for Suicide Squad at the time, though. It sounds like that... No one laughed at my Jim Cotta joke. Oh, well. Anyway, it sounds like he really would have fit in well with Suicide Squad, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually.
So he would have died like one appearance later.
I suppose that's possible.
This is the type of character that James Gunn could put in this new Suicide Squad movie, because there's some of the characters in this movie you're like, what? I mean, even I have to go like, okay, I don't even know who that is, and then I have to look it up. I mean, they should call it Mort Squad. I mean, instead of Suicide Squad.
So, Ryan, I take it you've already answered the question as to what your hopes and dreams are for Capoeira.
I think now more than ever, if the right person just remembered, if the right person remembers this character exists, if anybody at DC or working there is actually listening to this episode, first of all, hi, you know, join our Patreon. But, you know, if anybody just remember this character exists, I think he is very timely. It could be a very compelling character right now. And, yeah, bring him back. You could do a lot with this character today.
All right. Let's go on to Chris. Chris, back into the Marvel Universe. And I feel like the Marvel Universe guys are a little more high profile. So, but, I mean... Knee high, maybe. So what's your pick?
Okay, this is another Spider-Man introduced character. This is Buford Hollis, a.k.a. Razorback. He was in one of my very earliest Spider-Man comics, Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man number 14, which was cover date January 1978. But he actually first appeared two issues earlier. Well, his shadow did. It was just his shadow in Peter Parker number 12. And then he made his first full appearance in 13. But he was a trucker turned hero who dresses in a teal green bodysuit with yellow gloves, boots, and a belt. But the biggest thing about him, one, he's 6'8", weighs 410 pounds, so he's huge. And at some point, I guess somebody decided, well, he's got to be a mutant. He's just too big to not be a mutant, although that's never mentioned in his earliest appearances. But the big thing about this guy is he's from Arkansas. University of Arkansas's mascot is a Razorback. That's the team name, the football team. He has basically Pumbaa on top of his head. I mean, it's Hakuna Matata all day long with this guy. I mean, his face is sticking out of what looks to be a realistic looking warthog. I mean, it goes, the mane runs down his back. And this guy is, you know, he's a trucker. This came out during the CB craze. Bill Mantlow, who introduced him with Sal Buscema, called him the Citizens Band hero in this first Spider-Man storyline. So Convoy the Song was huge in 1977, probably right when Bill Mantlow was writing this story, Smokey and the Bandit hit theaters. So you can just imagine that this he is a hero of his time for sure and certain. But nowhere, I mean, despite the fact that this guy looks utterly ridiculous, he comes to New York. He's chasing down his sister who has joined this cult called the Legion of Light. And Bill Mantlow gives this guy like the hero's journey thing in this story. And he's basically wanting to come save his sister and also learn the ropes from the superheroes of New York. And he just happens to bump into Spider-Man and pick a fight with him because Spider-Man's also engaging this Legion of Light because Flash Thompson's Vietnamese girlfriend Shaw Shan has married this guy who's called Brother Power, not that one, not the geek, and she has become Sister Son, and they are leading this love cult called the Legion of Light, as I said. Turns out, you know, Spider-Man and him fight, and you know, Spider-Man eventually figures out that he doesn't really want to fight, that, you know, Spider-Man, like, threw the first punch because he happened to catch Spidey after he got knocked out of the window by Brother Power and Sister Son, as Shaw Shan was called. But this is some of his introductory dialogue, and it works a lot better if you read it like he's Jerry Reed from Smokey and the Bandit. So he said, "Sure, I hold no grudges, even if you did hit me first. Sides, this is just like I heard back at Hall Country at Texarkana, Arkansas. All you Eastern superhero types always stomp each other by way of introduction." So he got in a fight with Spider-Man because that's what he thought Eastern superheroes did.
I mean, there is a precedent for that.
Yeah. There is a precedent. And I like the fact that Mantlow addresses that. You know, that's fun. So the first comic book I bought, Spidey, Flash, and Razorback are chained up to this wall. They've chased the Legion of Light to this place. They found out that the guy behind all this is the Hate Monger. He's in the traditional Hate Monger purple clan outfit, you know, that way back from that old Fantastic Four issue where you find out the Hate Monger's like a clone of Hitler or whatever he was, you know?
Please, please, please tell me he's wearing a Timon mask. That would make it perfect.
Yeah. That'd be nice, but no, we'll get to that, what he is, in a minute. But they're chained up to the wall, and like, he pushes this button on his, well, Spidey has to hit this button on his belt because they're chained to the wall with his webs, and it activates his custom rig, the Big Pig, and it crashes through the wall, and it saves the day. Now, how did they actually get loose from the wall and not killed? I don't know. But anyway, just, you know, Sal Buscema's just, you know, of course, Sal Buscema draws somebody like opening the mail with like they're, you know, having a heart attack and your spittle going everywhere, and, you know, it's the Mighty Marvel Manor all over the place, but I love it, but it's insane. At the end of the story, you find out, okay, you've got a guy in a pig mask that's a trucker, you've got a love cult that's actually run by a bunch of supervillains, and then this Hate Monger guy pulls off his mask, and he's a freaking werewolf, because he's the man-beast from the Warlord series. I mean, Warlock. Sorry, not Warlord. That's something else. That's Darren and Ruth's thing. Warlock, you know, Adam Warlock. He's from that series. And how Bill Mantlow decided to put all these elements together in this storyline, I have no idea. But Razorback, you know, he's got the truck. He's got the outfit. But he's got an electrified mane as well that he built out of spare radio parts. So they're all in on this trucker thing. And throughout this storyline, you know, the hate monger gets, he goes to a big stadium. They're going to have this big love in at the stadium. Then the hate monger is going to release all his, you know, evil or man beast, I guess he really is. He's going to like, you know, use his powers to make everybody like tear each other apart. And he gets Spider-Man and Razorback to fight. And, you know, it's just this huge, big mess of a storyline. But in no time does Mantlow, I mean, yeah, he gives him that kind of, you know, he gives him that, that southern dialect that I know Martin Gray just loves to read in comic books. But, cause he loves when they, you know, spell out things phonetically. But Bill Mantlow is like, he's like setting this guy up for his own Marvel premiere, you know, 3-issue series till he gets his own book. You know, I mean, that's what's really crazy about it. It's like, nobody looked at this and said, this isn't going to work. You know, it's just, but he's so earnest that you can't help but love him. I mean, he's just a lot of fun. And he disappeared for years. He only showed up in Contest of Champions. You know, where everybody showed up in Contest of Champions. He didn't even get an Ohotmu entry, Siskoid, in either...
He's in the update.
Yeah, in the update. Yeah, but the reason he got it in the update is what I'll get to when we get to that later. So.
Yeah, well, I've always said that Bill Mantlow was the Bob Haney of the Marvel Universe, you know? There's something there. I think those two writers, there's a anything goes. The first time I ever met Razorback was it Sensational She-Hulk? The John Byrne She-Hulk.
Yep, I was the same way.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, because he brought in a lot of, well, Morts or forgotten characters or stranger characters into that series, and I met a lot of them there. And then they got an entry in the Who's Who update, or the Marvel, you know what I mean, the Marvel Universe update.
Yeah.
You should be familiar with it. I think you have a podcast on it.
That was the storyline I was going to bring up, that was a favorite
moment of yours from that series?
Yeah, because, I mean, the story of that is it ties into another Mort of note who had his own series, Ulysses Solomon Archer, a.k.a. US-1, who was another trucker superhero. Although Marvel was way behind the curve because, I mean, even BJ and the Bear had gotten canceled by that time, you know? I mean, the only people still using CBs were the Dukes of Hazzard in, you know, 1982 or whenever that book launched, 1, 2, whatever. Ulysses' girlfriend, Taryn, she gets with Razorback to go looking for him because he's gone out in space to become a space trucker. So Razorback hijacks this experimental space shuttle that Reed Richards was even working on. He's in this book. They even rope in Mr. Fantastic in this book. And he hijacks it, and She-Hulk manages to, you know, get aboard to find out what's going on. And, I mean, craziness ensues. But at the end of the storyline, She-Hulk convinces NASA to let him keep the experimental space shuttle as its test pilot, and he renames it Big Pig 3, which I don't know what happened to Big Pig 2. Somewhere, maybe each Contest of Champions, Big Pig 2 got destroyed or something. I don't know. But yeah, so he's roaming out there in space in Big Pig 3, and apparently he did it for a long time. He was eventually, like most Marvel characters, abducted by the Skrulls, and actually so was Frogman, and replaced. So both of those guys, the Skrulls went deep, man. They went deep. You know. That's deep in the bench when you could take those two guys out and replace them. But then I guess eventually he joined like one of the Avengers initiatives that you guys were talking about. So he's still around. Nothing horrible. They haven't done anything horrible to him. He hasn't been fed to real warthogs and, you know, and all or anything like that. So,
well, the initiative great. Was great for all those guys. I think Frogman was in the initiative as well.
Yes,
in Kentucky.
Was.
So, yes.
Oh, sweet.
Louisville. Yeah, I think so.
No, okay.
Oh, my gosh. That was absolutely insane. And I think the most important thing that we walked away from all this is, Chris, when exactly is the Smokey and the Bandit table read that we're doing? Because I'm in. I'm in completely.
Listeners, didn't you just feel in your heart that Chris was going to pick a character named Buford? Wasn't that the writing on the wall?
I'm stereotyping myself.
I hadn't read the Spectacular Spider-Man story. My first encounter with him was in Sensational She-Hulk and that other one, which I always love it because the cover when She-Hulk is fighting Zemnu, the giant white like space titan or whatever, because there's a play on... It's from an old science fiction horror story. I think it might be Ray Bradbury. I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Maybe it's not Ray Bradbury. I don't know. But
no, it's Harlan Ellison.
Oh, it's Harlan Ellison. There you go. Yeah, and then but the cover of the She-Hulk, because it's Zemnu. It says, I have no mouth and I am mean. But
by the way, you'll be hearing from Harlan Ellison's lawyers for getting that wrong, by the way.
I'm sure. Get in line. But the thing is, like, Chris, as you were describing it, now I'm thinking Razorback as Space Trucker, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. We're just going to see that as one of his...
Yes. 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 That's better than even what I was thinking. I'll get to that later. But yeah, let's do that one. Yeah, I love it.
What were your hopes and dreams before Ryan laid it all out?
Okay, yeah, phase 15 maybe. I do want a Marvel Legends figure, this guy. I mean, it just, I mean, his Who's Who entry, I mean, Who's Who, we keep saying that, his Ohatmu entry is actually drawn by John Byrne because he did do the She-Hulk. So when he finally got one, there's your template to make the action figure from. I want a Marvel, he can be the Build-A-Figure, because I want some, like, important character, like Captain America or Spider-Man, to come with a giant pig head in the package with him. So the kid can be like, Mommy, what happened to Pumbaa? You know, I was just thinking, okay, toy aside, you know, maybe if Falcon and the Winter Soldier goes on, I can just see it with these two guys, because the way they bicker and fight, you know, they're stranded like along some highway or something. And, you know, they're in Arkansas maybe, and something's happened to Sam's jet, you know, his wing pack, and they're just walking and they're arguing back and forth with each other. And all of a sudden the big pig pulls up and they get in, and there is Buford in the full outfit. And they're like, what the hell? And you could, like, explore this whole thing with, because of the Avengers and because they blew up and, you know, everybody loves them. And it's like, they've got all these, like, local guys that are trying to do the superhero thing now. It would be fun to just, like, have, like, one episode with Sam and Bucky in the truck with this guy, you know, going down the highway. I just think it'd be fun as hell.
Oh my gosh.
There's a lot to be done with that. I agree. Oh, okay. Well, let's look at mine. So I picked Null and Void. All right. So.
Yeah, you did.
Wait, the Null and Void?
It's a duo of Master Thieves who first appeared in World's Finest Comics number 293 in July of 83. Basically, that's my first issue of the book.
Oh, the beloved tail end of World's Finest. Everyone loves that era.
Well. There are, I mean, it often happened that in the lame duck era of the DCU, just, you know, the few years before Crisis, a lot of these books had these one-off villains that disappeared after Crisis. They were never brought back. That's what happened to Null and Void. They had more than one appearance, though. Anyway, that's a book that, because it was one of my first comics, or my first American comics, I read and reread it. Because they had such weird powers, I think it fueled my lifelong interest in strange power sets. I always like the characters that have very strange powers. So basically, they were retired at the time. They were older men, past their prime. They had a mystical tattoo in their hands. And when they shook hands, when the tattoos touched, they turned into Null and Void. Void was sort of a conduit who could touch an object with one hand and send it to the other. I say object, but he did it to Batman as well. And Void can, or Null, rather, could take away your senses. Superman's flying around and crashing into walls because he's in, like, a sensory deprivation field or something. And they both look very, very weird. So their whole shtick is basically disorientation. And after that first story, they appeared the next year in a four-parter that sort of explained their origin story and kind of broke up their friendship. And they were then never seen again. Somewhere around there, Superman gets sucked into Void's void. And there's like a whole dimension in there. And basically Trevor Von Eden doing his most Trevor Von Eden-ish world inside Void. And they never got a Who's Who entry. They never got a reboot. They just disappeared with the crisis, basically. But what I loved about them was that they had, like, this implicit history. They had been operating since the 40s, and they were just never caught. And that's why we don't know anything about them when they first appeared. So except on this, you know, they did the one last job trademark, you know? And of course, they get caught this time. But it, to me, it was, it's always your first comics, the ones when you've had very few issues at home, you read them, you reread them, and the characters take on like a bigger place in your imagination than they ever did in the world. And I gotta wonder why, and I'm asking you this, Ryan and I both picked DC characters and they were both obscure. Everybody went, huh? You know, and you guys picked Marvel characters that, and that actually had a life. And I think, like, I don't know, is Marvel better at supporting Morts? Is maybe the question. Is DC such a long history with different, like, it's easy to forget a character because, oh, Crisis, then we can never, we don't have to think about that part of it ever again or something. Is that what happens? Is there like a fundamental difference between the two companies, or is it just a coincidence based on our picks?
It could be partially too, the way the Marvel Universe was built to where the characters literally can just walk in and out of each other's books. I mean, there's much more of a chance of a character like, you know, like Razorback had been a Spider-Man character, but he can show up in She-Hulk's book, you know. I mean, I know Byrne was using goofy Mort characters, but it's just, it's kind of baked into the, I almost said MCU, huh, the MU, the Marvel Universe, that you just never know who's going to show up in a book. In DC, it's a little more, after the Silver Age and into the Bronze Age, once more creators came over, Marvel creators came over, it kind of changed to that a little bit, but there's still those fiefdoms of, you know, they made a huge deal of it, like when Weather Wizard came into Batman's book in the 60s, like, oh God, this never happens. Here's a Flash villain in a Batman book, you know? So I think that's another reason why, you know, they kind of like, if they're not used in that book, you know, with that character, with that hero or in that title, then they're probably not going to show up. Null and Void probably aren't going to show up in, you know, the new Teen Titans or whatever other book was being published at the time. And I do remember Null and Void. I did buy those comics, so I knew who you were talking about.
But Chris, I mean, piggybacking on what you were saying, I think that is partially baked into the DNA of Marvel Comics when you had the same two guys writing and drawing every comic in the line in the 60s. So it was just easier for them to recycle the same villains and the same characters and everything, and because it meant Stan and Jack didn't have to think of somebody brand new. If they could just use that same weird character who appeared in, you know, a Human Torch adventure, oh yeah, we'll put him back in, now he will give him another Spider-Man villain too, and then that's half of the Frightful Four, and, you know, kind of like throw them all together. So I think just kind of repopulating, reusing those was kind of just a necessary evil, just because Stan and Jack were just, when they were tired and lazy, when they just wanted to reuse some things. And that, because that was so much of what Marvel was about for almost a decade, it just became the formula. It became the Marvel style. And then, yeah, then throughout the 60s, 80s, 90s, and everything, yeah, it's just anticipated that they live in the same world. So one guy walks out of one book and into Captain America's book or something like that. Whereas DC has always felt like more fiefdoms and more like pocket little universes and everything like that that can occasionally cross over, but everybody has their own little area that they don't cross over as much.
So I would take it another step further, and I think you guys are absolutely right about the fiefdoms and the way the Marvel Universe developed instead of DC. But also, DC already, by the time Marvel came along, DC had 22, 23 years already of Mort characters. They'd already gone through all the 50s with all of these Mort characters they've forgotten. And then, you know, the good examples, Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon kept bringing back a lot of these, you know, Eraserhead characters, all these Mort-like characters that DC just forgot about. They just moved on. And so DC had already had a history of long, like, creating characters, throw them away if they didn't take and move on. Whereas Marvel, you know, very quickly, when Stan left, the writers of the Marvel series were all fanboys. And so they were all looking back with reverence at the stuff Stan and Jack had created and kept bringing back these characters because they loved them so much. So again, I think DC just had a longer history of building and moving on, whereas Marvel just, you know, they just kept recycling the stuff. And I will say, by the way, Null and Void, I don't remember these characters at all, but I absolutely adore the name because it reminds me of two things. One, the way Mike W. Barr would build characters in his Batman and the Outsiders. You basically find a term first and then build the characters around it. And second of all, that's exactly how I build villains in role-playing games. I find a fun phrase and I'm like, oh, look, now there's two of them.
Yeah, totally.
the same thing. Like I was thinking of you when you mentioned Bill Mantlo being the Bob Haney of Marvel. I was thinking they were responsible for things like Hawk and Dove and Cloak and Dagger, which are other just sort of like terms that just lend themselves to characters.
My new heroes, this and that. Yeah. But yeah, you mentioned Mike Barr. I mean, we could have populated this show just with his villains, you know, because there are so many one-off villains with kooky names based on the name, basically. I personally believe that a lot of Outsiders villains were Morts.
Oh, see, he's stating that very carefully, folks, because right before we began recording, he said all of Batman and the Outsiders villains were Morts.
Now I'm not qualifying in the same way. When we talked earlier, if they adopted a villain like Cobra. Well, now Cobra's not a Mort, but the Duke of Oil is a Mort. The nuclear family are Morts.
The nuclear family are not Morts. The nuclear family are not Morts.
Let us know in the comments. Are they Morts?
Go watch the Justice League action episode with them and Firestorm, and it's freaking genius.
Okay, I'll check that out.
I do want to mention, I used to have a fallback Mort that I used to reference all the time, and now I feel like I can't because he's kind of broken through, and that's Kite Man. I used to talk about Kite Man all the time as being a great Mort, but now he's not the star, but he's a very popular supporting character in the Harley Quinn animated series, which is really going like gangbusters. In fact, they dragged in Condiment King as well to sort of be a supporting character for that.
I think those are still Morts.
They're Morts, but they're Morts that kind of everybody knows now. I mean, there's not many people reading comics nowadays compared to the people that have watched that animated series on HBO.
Sure, but you did pick Frogman. You know, I mean, they're in the Frogman category.
Okay.
But back to Null and Void.
Oh, sorry.
Let me just, like, I don't know, talk about like a favorite moment. Basically, what I like about these characters when they're in play is that they've got great teamwork. They've got really unusual powers. They have a strong friendship that really mirrors the world's finest team, which is, I guess, was the whole point. Yet it manages to be a lot more believable in their dynamic. And in the end, you've got a senseless Superman smashing into a support beam. Everything in the museum starts to like fall apart. And Void actually starts saving civilians and Batman. Mm. And then that's how they get caught, basically, because they're thieves with hearts of gold, more or less. So I think there was a lot more history to them. And if I were to say, what are my plans for the future? I feel like Bronze Age losers get resurrected much more seldom than Silver Age ones. These guys could easily have returned at any given point if Blackbriar Thorn could be a thing later on. He was also just a one-off villain, you know, in a team-up book. Of course, there's the Joe Kubert element, you know, that gave him his Who's Who page and then stardom, well, of a kind. But if he can make it, I think these guys are unusual enough that they could have made. You mentioned the Suicide Squad earlier. I think they would have been a great fit in the Suicide Squad. You keep them around for a while. They've got covert skills, basically. And then you kill one off. And the other one is like trapped maybe in the weird look because he can't tattoo out. You know, that kind of thing would have created drama. Of course, I'm rewriting history because I'm putting them in the Suicide Squad back in the day when the book was great. But at any given point, I could bring back these characters.
Do you get the vibe from them as these older gentlemen who've been... do you get like a Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau grumpy old men vibe with them bickering with each other?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit Odd Couple. It's a little bit original Ocean's 11. It's a little bit, you know, it's if I were writing for DC, I would bring these characters back, point blank. I would do something with them.
Cool.
If. It's a big if.
Is Nort from Justice League International, who got introduced as a joke, is he a Mort or not?
Nord the Mort?
Yeah, right. Is he?
Can a Green Lantern really be a Mort?
Within the Green Lantern core, he's a Mort. In the JLI, he's not really, because there's so much goofiness running on in that comic. So
that's it, I guess. Anything you guys want to shill as, exciting stuff coming to your podcast in the near future?
Well, we've got the Smoking the Bandit table read now on the docket. We've got Frogman cast coming soon. What do you guys got?
I might have to bring one of my Black Canary blogs back because I'm thinking of a bunch of villains and everything like Morts that I could resurrect, and I've got all these ideas. Yeah, So there was one that I almost picked, a Silver Age Green Arrow villain called the Red Dart, who I think only had one appearance until maybe like within the last 5 or 6 years or something was brought back. But he looked like the Crimson Avenger, and he threw a dart. And he was in one Silver Age story that I read in like the Showcase black and white volume. And I thought Red Dart would be a great nemesis for Green Arrow. Because for like a long time, Green Arrow's arch nemesis was like Merlin, who was just an archer without even an interesting costume. But I was like, Red Dart, it's another... it's a thrown projectile, so it's sort of like an arrow, but it's different. You could still do the same thing. It could be poison tipped, or could it be explosive? You revise his costume a little bit, but he could be like so deadly accurate with darts. He could be like Green Arrow's version of Bullseye. And I was like, that is just a you got the gimmick right there. It's just a perfect thing. Just somebody do something with him. But alas.
Apparently they have.
Didn't Grant Morrison do something with him in JLA toward the end of his JLA run, or am I nuts?
I'm looking right now. There is a new Red Dart. It's a woman who's got like half her head shaved, and she's appeared in 14 issues. One of them was a Grant Morrison JLA issue.
Okay. I don't remember that.
They're never really dead.
There you go.
I think, you know, future projects, Ryan needs to use our YouTube channel to video some of that sexy dance fighting. We can get a Patreon going for that. You know, if we hit 750 or something, then, you know, let Ryan go nuts with that. How about that?
I mean, I asked the question seriously, but I almost feel like maybe I should have asked people to shill podcasts that are already dead or that are morts themselves. So listen to Lonely Hearts. Well, anything that Ryan does and, you know.
Dead Buff and Spies. Yeah.
Hero points. I really do want to do some Red B stuff for JSA Presents, and he's one. Oh my gosh, Red Dart was an arrow. Holy crap.
The TV show Arrow?
Apparently, yes, she was in the TV show Arrow.
I thought I was the only person who remembered this character.
Guys, live action is where our morts are going to appear next.
Oh my gosh.
Screw the comics. Live action is where we're going to watch for the Big Pig 2 or 3. It's going to happen.
Live action is where all of the DC characters are going to exist soon.
So on that note, we have to mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. Well, obviously. So if you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation, the amount of which will allow you to unlock rewards like suggesting programming like this one. So again, our thanks to Chris Lewis for suggesting it. Hope you had fun with it. A reminder that you can leave us comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also follow the Fire and Water Facebook page or on Twitter. The account is FW Podcasts. So thanks a lot, guys, for doing this with me.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
Frogman out.
That's it for us.
I've got the song Convoy stuck in my head now, Chris.
Well, let Convoy play us out.
Well, we laid a strip for the Jersey Shore and prepared to cross the line. I could see the bridge was lined with bears, but it didn't have a doggone dime. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck. We just ain't gonna pay no toll. So we crashed the gate doing 98. I says, let them truckers roll 10-4.
Cross the Almighty Convoy.